Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Impact of influence.
Covering true crime throughout the Southeast.
Hello, friend. Matt Harris and Seton Tucker. Check out Impact of Influence on Facebook. And from there, you can find the YouTube channel. We are getting rolling. Also, we'd love it if you rate and share the episode. Give it 100 stars, if that's possible, and comment on it. And of course, we'd love to hear your comments, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on cases we should cover. As you know, it's not going to be all Murdoch all the time, doing cases throughout the Southeast. We've done a few of those, and we're working on some other ones. We're getting lots of feedback and ideas.
Yes, lots of tips and cases that people would like us to cover. So we are looking into them. If we've not gotten back to you, please send us a reminder because we're getting so many.
We'll be on it. We're also looking to have guests that know about the case, whether it be attorneys, former law enforcement, etc. So what else do you have for us, Seton?
Well, we got some feedback from our last episode where we covered Alec Murdoch's federal financial crime sentencing. And someone has told me they do not believe that Alec Murdoch is going to be eligible for the First Step Act. He probably will only qualify for the 52 days a year of good time that you get basically as long as you just don't burn the jail down. But the First Step Act, you have to have a criminal history in a category zero. And right now, Alec Murdoch has a four. Also, another thing that would preclude you from participating in this First Step Act would be creating substantial financial harm to people, which
that happened,
which has happened. So anyway, just some feedback on that.
And speaking of Alec Murdoch, that's why we have our guest today, because Alec, as you know, failed the polygraph the feds gave him about the money crimes. And so we found a guest who has written a book about the history of the polygraph and lie detector. Let's bring in our guest, Amit Katwala. He is a writer and editor for Wired, books, magazine features, podcasts, videos. You can see his TED Talks. You can find those on YouTube. And the book that we're talking about today that I got on Friday and blew through it in the weekend because it was so intriguing, Tremors in the Blood, Murder Obsession and the Birth of the Lie Detector. Thanks for joining us, Amit. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
Well, I wanted to just start off with a basic question. How did you become interested in this polygraph subject?
Well, you'll like this answer because it started out with an interest in true crime. I was watching Making a Murderer. I don't know if you remember that from a few years ago.
Yeah.
Stephen Avery and that case up in the north of America. And in the second season of that show, Stephen Avery goes through something called a brain fingerprinting test, where he goes under a brain scan, which is apparently designed to tell whether or not he's lying about the murders that he allegedly committed. And my background's in psychology and neuroscience, and watching this thing playing out on screen, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. This can't be true. So I did some digging and I ended up writing a story for The Guardian about the kind of new science of lie detection. And as I was researching that story, what I found was a lot of parallels between the new science of lie detection, and I say science in sort of inverted commas here, and the kind of history of, you know, science or pseudoscience that was linked to the original lie detector, the polygraph machine. And so I kind of went down this rabbit hole, and I spent the next kind of couple of years basically digging into the history of the polygraph, finding all these problems with it, and then also these incredible sort of true crime stories that were like woven into to the history of this machine. And this machine, which had a massive influence on the justice system and continues to have a massive influence on the justice system, particularly in the States.
And I will tell you, people, if you're true crime fans, this has many stories that he covers in depth about crimes that were committed or maybe not committed by the people that were the lie detector was used against. And so you'll enjoy it, even if it's not from the historical perspective of how it all came together. But the lie detector, it's over 100 years old. And the two main people that started it was police chief Gus Volman, got together with a rookie officer, John Larson, eventually Leonard Keeler. Larson was a cop with a PhD. Explain how the Volmer, the police chief, and John Larson got together and their basic idea of what they were going to come up with, which would be called the polygraph.
Yeah, so basically, to take you back to the time the polygraph was invented, right? So policing in the kind of 1890s, early 20th century was a very unscientific profession, I can put it that way. So it was a lot of kind of family ties and people kind of getting, you know, confessions beaten out of them with sticks and fists. And Volmer was a veteran of the Spanish-American War, and he wanted to make policing a bit more humane, and he wanted to also make it a bit more scientific. He was based in Berkeley, California. And the resource that he had available to him being in Berkeley was a lot of kind of smart young college graduates. And he was basically the person who decided to kind of try and bring those sorts of people into policing, and then to try and bring in new technologies to help solve crime. So he brought in things like fingerprinting, he brought in things like radios so that officers could communicate, he brought in maps of crime so that he could identify hotspots. And then one of the other things he brought in was, yeah, he brought in this college cop, they were called. So there's this PhD student called John Larson, who was a criminologist who wanted to try and prevent crimes before they happened. And together they cooked up this idea to basically see whether they could use blood pressure to tell when someone was lying. And that was the sort of genius, the seed that became the polygraph machine.
Reading some of your articles, this situation at Berkeley, it sounded like it might be a terrible time to be a student there, because they really used this polygraph on the students to uncover lots of different crimes. I think it started out with some stolen jewelry. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like, I studied psychology, and even today, if you are a psychology student or a neuroscience student at an undergraduate, you will get experimented on. It's just kind of part of the course.
True.
but yeah, so Larson and Volmer built this machine. So it was kind of this very sort of ramshackle-looking machine. Someone in the papers at the time described it as sort of a mix between an alarm clock and a wireless radio and a sort of blood pressure cuff, and it looked very ugly. But anyway, they built this machine. And yeah, one of the first cases they used it on was this case of a series of thefts at a women's dorm in Berkeley at the university. And basically, a bunch of the women that staying at this dorm had their thing go missing, and the police were called. And eventually, the investigating officer sort of, I think, grew tired of interviewing dozens of women and kind of shoved the case over to Larson and was like, you deal with it with this new machine you've got. So that was the first case the polygraph was used on. And actually, the first person that they used the polygraph on was a woman called Margaret Taylor, who was one of the victims of this crime. So I guess, as is normal in police interviewing, you sort of, the first thing you do is interview the victim to try and, you know, narrow down the scope of your inquiries. And this is a bit of a side note, but Larson actually then ended up eventually marrying this woman. So that's sort of an early sign that maybe in a polygraph exam, the sort of power imbalance is not quite what it should be.
And he brought her back in and asked her if he loved her.
Or she loved him.
Loved him, yeah. And she actually lied.
Well, according to that test, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite it's quite an interesting story, actually, and it's sort of got this sort of almost like rom-com style meet cute sort of thing of, yeah, her, him strapping her at a lie detector and saying, you know, do you love me, and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, so they thought that they'd use the machine to kind of solve this crime, and they pinned the crime on a woman called Helen Graham, and she confessed and all seemed good. And then a few months later, she sort of tried to recant her confession. So even back then, there were these problems beginning to emerge, even with the first few cases the lie detector was actually used on.
And there's two big cases that you go into great detail and very interesting detail that show both sides of the polygraph in a way. And one of them, I guess the combination kind of broke some of the people that were involved with the beginning of the polygraph. One of those cases was Henry Wilkins in 1922. So it's only like a year after the invention of it. And I know that the case is, you, like I said, you cover it amazingly, but give us a synopsis of that and why that became a centerpiece of your story.
Yeah, so you're right. So it's May 1922, it's San Francisco, and Henry Wilkins is a mechanic. He's like a German immigrant, and he's driving back from a camping trip with his family. So he's got his wife in the car and his two kids, and they get pulled over by bandits, basically, and kind of held up at the roadside. And in the kind of struggle, his wife gets shot. And, you know, he rushes to the hospital, but she passes away. And when the police come, he kind of says, you know, there was these three guys, and they, you know, held us up. And then, you know, when they tried to grab her jewelry, I reached for my own gun, and then they tried to shoot me, and she jumped across and saved me, but she got shot. So that was the kind of story that he told the police. And anyway, it kind of, over the next few weeks and months, that story sort of unravels, and it turns out that maybe Henry Wilkins was actually involved in his own wife's death. So, you know, the police identify two suspects, then in a police lineup, he claims that he never met the suspects, and then it transpires later in the week that actually he used to work with one of them. And then when they follow him after a meeting, they see him meeting these suspects or one of their brothers. So it's all very, it starts to not look very good for Henry. And that's when the polygraph gets called in. And the reason that I chose to focus on this case is, well, for a couple of reasons. First, because it's a bonkers case. Like, I don't want to get into all the twists and turns of it, because we'll be here all day. But, you know, there's gunfights and, you know, love triangles and all sorts of mad stuff going on. And then the second reason was that it was one of the first times the polygraph had been used in a murder case. And it was one of the first significant cases where the polygraph sort of failed, I think. So it had been used in a couple of murder cases up until this point, and it sort of got, you know, the right answer in inverted commas, in that what was found on the polygraph kind of matched up with what the jury found and what the police had found. Whereas was here, what happened was that the evidence seemed to point overwhelmingly in terms of like Henry being guilty, but the polygraph actually found him innocent. And, you know, he walked free, and though he did eventually go to trial, he was found innocent. And for John Larson, that was a real sort of blow, and it really like changed the way that he thought about this machine he'd invented. He started to think of it as sort of a Frankenstein monster that he'd unleashed on the world. And he spent basically the rest of his life trying to undo the damage, trying to put this machine back in the box that he, you know, inadvertently released it from.
I think they're called countermeasures, where people tried to find ways to beat the polygraph test. And it appears as if maybe in this case he did. What are those, and what are some of the ways that people have tried to beat polygraph tests?
Yeah, the way a polygraph works is it looks for a difference between your response to control questions and your response to target questions. So a control question might be, is your name Henry? And a target question might be, did you kill her? Right. So, and the theory that it works on is that, you know, if you're asked a question about the crime and you did the crime, then your pulse will go up, your blood pressure will go up, and those changes will be measurable, and you'll be able to spot them on the chart. So that's a theory. So countermeasures try and mess with that. So countermeasures might try and, for instance, exaggerate your response to the control questions so that when the target questions come around, the difference isn't as big. So you can do that by clenching your muscles. So if you like clench your butt while you're being asked a target question, a control question, then don't do that. When you get asked a target question, then the responses will look the same. So that's one thing. People have tried kind of like pinching themselves or putting a pin in their shoe and then stepping on it when they get asked these control questions. So anything that's going to amp up your physical response to the control questions so that when you get asked a target question, the difference between the two responses isn't as big, can be used as a countermeasure.
Let's talk about one of our sponsors. It is Factor. You can eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals.
Every fresh meal is never frozen and is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, and they are ready in just 2 minutes.
Where did you have chili the other day?
Delicious.
And if you want gourmet meals, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, asparagus. So head to factormeals.com/impact50 and use code impact50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box.
That code's impact50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Impact 50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And who doesn't love going to the movies?
It is my favorite date night activity, and my daughter, she's a huge movie goer.
Oh yeah, I just went to Kung Fu Panda 4 the other week at Regal Cinemas, and they're doing this cool thing called Regal Unlimited. Explain, Seton.
It is an all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass that pays for itself in just 2 visits.
Nice.
You can see any standard 2D movie anytime with no blackout dates or restrictions.
Love that. And also, if you want to do the souped-up versions, you want to watch a movie in a premium format like 4DX, IMAX, RPX, ScreenX, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost.
And you don't just save on tickets, you also save on snacks.
Members get 10% off all non-alcoholic concession items. So if you're planning to see 2 movies this month, you need to join Regal Unlimited. Sign up now in the Regal app or on regmovies.com/unlimited. regmovies.com/unlimited. And use our code IMPACTREG. Do it now. Great job in telling the story of the Wilkins case. And the other big one that you had a lot of focus on was one that really tore Larson apart later in life. And that was the case of Rappaport.
That's right.
And that was like the opposite of the other one where Henry Wilkins was guilty and Rappaport probably was innocent. Explain that case in a nutshell.
Yeah, and it's not even, I'm not even sure. To be honest, I'm not sure whether he was innocent or not. So the second case, so in Chicago, this is in Chicago, so it's 11 years later, kind of mid-1930s in Chicago, and Joe Rappaport is he gets basically accused of killing this guy called Max Dent. So Max Dent was sort of a kind of drug pusher and sort of low-level police informant, basically. And then Joe Rappaport gets accused of killing him because the motive was supposedly that Max Dent was about to testify against him. Right. And he goes to trial, gets found guilty, gets given the death penalty, and By this point, Leonard Keeler, who we've not talked about yet, so Leonard Keeler was sort of John Larson's protege, and he was this kind of high school kid when they met, and he's the one who really was responsible for like popularizing the lie detector and spreading it across America.
He was trying to make some money off of it.
So he was the one who was kind of trying to turn it into a commercial project, I guess, you know, trying to make money out of it effectively, whereas Larson was more about the pure science. Keeler was the showman, the salesman. And so by the mid-1930s, Keeler was living in Chicago. Larson had been in Chicago, but then had to leave in disgrace for a bunch of slightly lurid reasons that I get into in the book. And basically what happened was that Rappaport was on death row, and the governor of Illinois, Henry Horner, kept giving him stays of execution. He was being pressurized by Rappaport's family and the community to not execute him. So he kept giving him stays of execution. And after, I think, 3 or 4 of these, he eventually said, right, okay, if this guy can pass a lie detector test that says he's innocent, I'll commute the sentence. I'll let him live. So Keeler kind of goes along to the jail with the polygraph equipment, straps the Rappaport in. He fails the test and, you know, is executed shortly afterwards. And the challenge here is not so much whether or not he was guilty. It's more like, you know, he was found you know, this machine, this unreliable machine, was basically used to decide whether or not a man lived or died. And that is, like, hugely problematic. And, yeah, for Larson, as you said, it was sort of...
Didn't Keeler, like, when he did the test, he was not even doing it the way he was supposed to do it. He was breaking all the rules.
You're right. He was breaking all the rules. If you look at... And I think the media kind of does things a bit of a disservice, and I understand why, because if you actually were to sit and watch a lie detector test being done in real time the way it should be done, it's very, very boring and very, very long, because you're meant to ask each question several times. You're meant to wait like a minute between each question to let the bodily response settle down. Yeah. It takes ages. This is like a 4, 5, 6 hour thing. It's a real marathon. Whereas obviously on TV, it's sort of like, you know, people get strapped in and then, you know, 10 minutes later, they're, you know, getting marched out again with a piece of paper saying, you know, they were lying or whatever. And, above all, it's meant to be in a sort of, you know, neutral setting. And, you know, death row is not a neutral setting. And, while that report was being put on the machine, you know, the lights in the cell that he was in were flickering because they were testing the electric chair in the next room.
Jeez. Oh, my goodness. That, you know. That sounds like a calm environment
there. Yeah, really.
You just mentioned the media. And, you know, we see these true crime TV shows, Law and Order, and someone gets a lie detector test and they fail. And we also see headlines here in the States that someone, you know, passed or failed a polygraph test. And you kind of get this assumption of guilt or innocence based on whether someone has passed this. But the reliability is not as black and white as what you're led to believe in the media.
Yeah, that's right. And if you look at kind of the scientific work that's been done on the accuracy of the lie detector, it can be as low as, you know, 40% sometimes. You know, it ranges between 40% and 70%. It varies wildly depending on who's actually conducting the test. And it's presented as this sort of scientific machine that's giving you like unbiased results. But really, it's a lot of it's about interpretation. A lot of it's about who's doing the test and who's being tested. There's a huge amount of bias in the process as well. Ultimately, it's akin to, you know, reading tea leaves or, you know, doing a palm reading or something like that, right? Like it's operating at that level. And I have to be quite careful when I talk about this, because obviously, like, it can be useful and it can be, you know, it has obviously helped, you know, bring people to justice. But, you know, I think when it is useful, it's often as a sort of like psychological prop in a way. It's sort of the illusion of science, right? Someone I speak to about this, an academic, calls it sort of zombie forensics, right? This, you know, akin to security theater at airports. It's there to make the subject feel like they're under interrogation by a machine that's going to rat them out if they don't tell the truth.
Well, as a matter of fact, you talk about, I don't know if a Chicago police or somebody was using like a copier or something, right? And just telling the criminal to put the hand in the copier and it would shoot out if they were telling the truth.
Yeah, that's right. So that's actually in David Simon's book, his nonfiction book. And then he recreates that scene in The Wire. So yeah, exactly. But I think originally it was in Detroit, and then obviously in The Wire, it's in Baltimore. But yeah, they used to get the suspects to put their hand on a Xerox machine, and then they would just get the machine to print out a piece of paper with "he's lying" written on it. And that would be enough to sort of, you know, convince them that they just had to tell the truth. It's sort of about the psychological pressure that the machine, or even the idea of a machine, can put on people.
Well, the guys who invented it, you know, ended up being against it, and they even called it, I believe, a psychological form of torture, which they were hoping to get away from by having this device. And yet it's been 100 years of this. And it's basically still the same thing it's measuring that it was in 1921?
Essentially, yeah. So the only difference is that, you know, back then you would have had physical pens. So all the equipment, the blood pressure cuff and the thing, the cables that wrap around your chest would be connected to physical pens, and your movement would translate into the movement of the pens. Whereas now it's more likely to be connected to a kind of a computer, and the lines will be not on a piece of paper, but on the chart. But everything else is basically the same. They've added kind of a sweat response. So sometimes you'll see on TV, like, people will have something attached to their finger that's measuring their galvanic sweat response. So that's just another kind of way, another source of information. But even now, a lot of the interpretation is still sort of done by eye, by feel. You know, there's no sort of objective way of doing it. There were efforts to create objective, you know, unbiased polygraph scoring algorithms in the 80s, but polygraph examiners didn't really want them. And I think they kind of you know, that's a kind of tacit admission that what they do is more art than science, right? It's more about interrogation and personal, interpersonal skills, I guess, than it is about the science of the machine.
One thing that polygraphs can be used for is as an investigative technique, but we often see these as part of deals. If you're going to make a deal with the federal government or that sort of thing, it's a requirement to take and pass a polygraph test. How do you see these two different types of ways of using a polygraph important?
Yeah, so there's something similar that's been happening in the UK recently as well, where it's being increasingly used to assess people who are on probation for, you know, sex offences or for terrorism offences. It's being used. And look, I think that it can be useful in those cases, but I think it needs to be used with eyes open about, you know, the reliability and the accuracy of it. And actually, like, I think in the case that you guys have been following on this podcast, I actually don't mind it being used in that scenario because it's fairly low stakes in the sense that, mm-hmm. you know, the guy's already in prison and this is about, you know, assessing whether or not it's about trying to extract more information from him, right? And, you know, if you can't get that information from him, then, okay, the stakes are relatively low in terms of, like, no one's going to die as a result or that kind of thing. Whereas the problem I have with it is that, you know, if you put too much weight on these tools and you end up letting guilty people walk free, then that can lead to really severe consequences. There was a serial killer in the Pacific Northwest in the, I think, the 70s and 80s, maybe 90s actually, called Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, he was called. And he, you know, killed a bunch of women, was brought in, was polygraph tested, passed the polygraph test, was let go and went on to, like, kill loads more people. And that's really problematic when the machine gets the wrong result. And because it's a machine and we kind of, you know, believe in science and we trust machines more than we trust ourselves, it sort of leads to these, you know, wrong outcomes.
I think the number is somewhere around 200 people that we know of unjustly imprisoned in, I think, just England alone due to failed polygraphs. Is those numbers close?
Yeah, so that's actually, I think that figure's from the United States, actually. But
States, okay.
Yeah, there are loads of cases. If you look at the kind of the Innocence Project and things like that, there are several documented cases of people being coerced into confessing on polygraphs, and then actually it turns out later on that, you know, they were telling the truth. And like you say, like, those kind of, it's really hard to tell whether someone's pulse is racing because they're lying or because they're nervous, right? You know, if you're afraid of being wrongly accused, you know, how are you supposed to determine whether someone's stressed because they're afraid of being wrongly accused or because they're afraid of being found out, right? It's really, really difficult for a polygraph machine to figure that out.
Just a person that sweats a lot has a problem with
it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or someone who's nervous for other reasons, right? You know, and I think being interrogated about a murder is probably a pretty nervous situation to be in, regardless of whether you did it or not.
Do polygraph examiners go through any sort of training? Is there any sort of standard? Because it seems to me that there could be some polygraph examiners who are better than others.
Yeah, so there is a organization called the American Polygraph Association. However, it's not compulsory. So, you know, there's nothing to stop you from going out, buying a polygraph, starting to test people. You can become a polygraph examiner, a licensed polygraph examiner. I think it takes 12 weeks, I think the course is.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, it's really, really quite straightforward. And, you know, you can basically go from, you know, being someone with no interrogation experience to being, you know, a licensed, qualified polygraph examiner in, yeah, less than a year. And
oh, wow.
It just blows my mind that all these studies and all these facts show that it's pseudoscience. And I wonder if the people who tout it really believe it, or do they have some sort of other motive? I mean, do they really convince themselves that they know a liar?
Probably two things happening. I think there's probably at the coal face, I think people probably do believe that it works. And, you know, I think they probably do believe that they're getting the right results. And I think, to be honest, like, a lot of the time they probably are. It's just the problem is that these, like, edge cases, right? These, you know, if you're going to use technology to, you know, sentence someone to death or send them to prison for the rest of their life, then you really, really need to be sure that it's, like, 100% accurate. So I think that's part of it. And then I think the other reason that it proliferates is because it's convenient, right? It's much more convenient for a police department to get a confession out of someone on a polygraph machine than it is to take them to trial. It's much more expensive to take them to trial than it is to, you know, sit them in a room with an examiner for 2 hours and come out with a confession.
Right, right. The book is fantastic. Tremors in the Blood, Murder Obsession, and the Birth of the Lie Detector. Amit, thank you very much for spending time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right. We are wrapping this one up. Please rate and share the episode. Check out the YouTube channel. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, I should say. And check out the Facebook page of Impact of Influence. Are you good, Seton? Are you good?
I'm good.
Do you want me to hook you up to a lie detector and ask you some questions?
I honestly think that I would fail a lie detector test. And not, I think I could pass the questions like, you know, do you...
Your name?
Right. Or, you know... Yes. What's your name? You know, do you like dogs? That sort of thing. I think I could pass. But you automatically ask someone, are you guilty of killing your neighbor? Just saying that makes my heart race.
Well, I think of it in a smaller case when I was married. Or if you're married and you walk in, right? And they like say like, where have you been? Sometimes you feel like a guilty for a second.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Even though you didn't do anything, weren't anywhere. You're like, what? Was I? Did I?
Did I?
Or when I go through the airport, go to the metal detector, sometimes I'm like, did I accidentally hide something in my... I don't know. Well, that's a little much. All right. Well, there you go. we will talk soon, friend.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an evergreen podcast, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.